vague idea where we're going and how we're going to get there, but I'm open to digressions along the way. All right. Well, as noted, the mob that we are referring to is a scene where you have more than two people talking. As I noticed when I was writing Outlander, which I wrote for practice in order to learn how to write a novel, and therefore I was paying attention to how it was done, I noticed not only that most of the books that I read and were using for reference and so forth, I've been reading since I was 3 years old, so I read a lot of books, but casting my mind back, you know, most conversations are between two people. I mean, it's called dialogue for a reason, it's because there's usually two people talking. Monologue is one person. There is no word for multiple people talking at once or in a conversation. And this, in fact, happens fairly infrequently in fiction, for good reason. It's difficult to handle that many people. It happens much more frequently in the visual medium, and I've sort of gained a new perspective on this in recent years because of the television show that's based on my books. I am a consultant on the show, which means they show me the scripts, they show me the dailies, the daily footage. It's actually pixelage, but they still call it footage, that they shoot every day. And so while the show is filming, which is about 9 months of the year, I get dailies 5 days a week, which are very interesting. I don't normally watch all of them because it's take after take after take, unless it's a really interesting scene, in which case I will watch every single bit. And you know, you get to see the clapperboard data at the beginning, which is there for a reason. It tells you, you know, which season it is, which episode it is, who is the director, who is the director of photography. And then it tells you which scene it is, and it will be like scene 30, but then there may be a letter after it, 30A, 30B, 30D, etc. And this means it's a long scene, so we're not going to shoot it in one long take. We're going to break it up into shorter takes, but they are contiguous. Sometimes they overlap, sometimes it's one after another. And you have the camera data. It says, you know, B or A or C. I don't think I've ever seen one with four cameras, but A, B, and C are the various cameras that they'd be using. Mostly they use just A and B because most scenes are involving two people. One camera is focused on each of the main characters, unless it is a larger scene, in which case you will have a C camera, which is focusing on the other characters in between. And the cameras all are going, you know, long shot, close up, or, you know, turning, do it from the side, that sort of thing. Midway through each filming of a scene, the assistant director will shout, turning around, which means that everybody can break and go back to their trailers for 45 minutes rest, because it's going to take them that long to move the cameras from one side of the set to the other. They are literally turning around and photographing it from the other direction, which allows them to get, you know, a different view of the set and you know, a different view of the characters. Now, when it comes to actually putting this stuff together, that is the film editor's job, and they have vast quantities of this footage to deal with. And so they can take, you know, single takes from here and from there, they can take many takes, they can cut the film and take a few seconds here, a few seconds there. And it's fascinating to see if you watched how it was filmed and then how it comes out in the episodes. And they're just now beginning to show me the preliminary cuts of the assembled episodes, which still have gaps and things. But from there I can see, because I've recently seen the takes of this, I can see exactly which pieces they used and how they put them together. And so that gives me kind of a visual notion of how you tell a story. Now, when you're dealing in visual terms, TV and movies and so forth, it's a lot easier to manage a mob because it is visual. You know, you show, you know, the downtown Brownsville, and here are all these people, you know, with guns and costumes and so forth. You just see them, they're kind of a mass, but then the camera will zero in on one here, one there. And they may not be important characters, they're just interesting looking, but it's used to, you know, provide specificity to your mind's eye. In other words, it's not just a faceless mob, it is this person and this person and this person. And then when they pull back and it's a mob again, you are cognizant of it as being separate people. And you can use something like that when you're writing, which we'll get into a little bit later here, but that is one of the important things, is when you are dealing with more than one person, provide a little specific visual type details of the other people as you go along. It shouldn't be long descriptions or anything like that, just enough to make it fairly vivid. And so people have, you know, just a faint picture of that guy. So when he speaks, you know, they'll have that in mind. It's much easier to follow a line of action or of conversation if you can see the people talking, so to speak. So that's what you want to do for your reader, is actually let them see who is talking in this menage. Now, usually you will have two people talking, as I said, and that's what I did while I was writing Outlander, you know, for the first 3 months or so. Everything I wrote was, you know, Claire and Frank, Claire and Mrs. Baird, you know, Claire and Jamie and so forth. And it was just two people, which, you know, after a while I began to feel somewhat comfortable with writing dialogue and knowing who these people were. But as I say, I was also cognizant of writing technique because I had seen such a lot of it. And I was thinking, well, you know, it seems kind of difficult, you know, envisioning the idea of doing a mob scene. How would you handle a scene that has more than two people in it? Because, you know, it seems rather constrained if you're going to have the whole book with only two people conversing. I mean, you can essentially do this if it's a short book and it won't bother anyone. But if you have a long book, something involving a lot of action, something involving, you know, a good bit of back and forth, so to speak, then you kind of need to handle multiple people, you know, chipping in and so forth. So there's four basic principles that you use to do this, which I will tell you briefly. So this thing would like to cooperate by opening up. Yes, that would be good. All right. Yeah, so they're relatively simple. The main thing is your point of view character. You know who that is, presumably, by this time. And the key to managing a mob scene is to know who your point of view character is and stay firmly in their head at all times. You see what they see, nothing else. They can hear things, you know, from around them, they see things, but the reader is going to see, what they notice. So you want to stay firmly in that point of view character because that's your guide through what may otherwise be a fairly confusing scene. Now there is an exception to this called an elided point of view, but that's very advanced stuff technically. I will tell you about it if we have time toward the end, but otherwise don't worry about it because it's, I think I've only used it three times in my books and I don't see most other people use it at all, so you can easily get along without it. Okay, so point of view character. The second thing is what is your context? You want to keep a grip on your context. And there's two variations on this. You have the situational context. Where is this? Are you having dinner? Is it a tense, you know, are you gathered around a table deciding the further conduct of the war? You know, there's a scene in season two where the Jacobite generals are all talking about whether to turn back from Derby or not. And so they're all, you know, constrained in this little room around a table and yelling at each other over the table, a lot of pushing and shoving. And the real thing, of course, is the relationship between Jamie Fraser at one end of the table and Bonnie Prince Julie at the other end of the table. So people are putting in all these, you know, sort of informational bits, you know, we have to turn back because this, well, we can't do that because that, is so you know what's going on. So here you have the situational context, you know what the conflict is, and you are sort of following it. So none of what these other people are saying is actually important, but the fact that they're saying it is important because they're providing you the situational context. So this is where you get in little bits of information that you need about your situation. The other thing is the physical context. You know, where are you? You need to know what the room looks like, not in any great detail, but the overall impression of it. And also if you're having dinner, for instance, what's on the table? Because, you know, these props may come into use in your dialogue, and if not, then they will at least give, you know, a visual anchorage point for your reader. So you need to keep track of point of view character, the situational context, and physical context. Okay, and then, very important, you need to follow the thread of the action through here. Okay, now what the action is may be purely conversational. It may be someone telling a story about something that's already happened, or it may be people contemplating action, as in the scene that I mentioned, or it may be, you know, actual physical action happening in front of you right now. But you need to follow that thread because that's what's going to guide your reader through that scene. You give them the other things to anchor them and orient them, but what they're actually looking at is the thread of action that's going through there. As I say, it can be physical action or conversational action or both. Okay, and then finally the one that I told you before, use small specific details when someone speaks to give the reader a quick mental picture of them. So essentially what you're doing is translating, visual medium techniques into text, which is not usually what you do. You usually do it the other way and translate the text into a visual medium. And it is really true that a picture is worth 1,000 words in terms of that. And it is much easier to do mob scenes and things like that on television or in film. But you can do it in text. So just as a quick illustration with commentary, I will read you my very first attempt at writing a scene with more than two conversational people. And this is from Outlander, which, you know, remember, this is my practice book. Okay, this takes place in the dining room at Castle Leoch. I glanced down the dinner table and across the room. Okay, this is a clue, we're gonna look at the room. By now I knew most of the faces, some intimately, and a motley crew they were, I reflected. Frank would have been fascinated by the gathering, so many different facial types. And this is a little flashback, she's still thinking about Frank, so we know that where her affections are, etc. Thinking about Frank was rather like touching a sore tooth. My inclination was to shy away. But the time was coming when I would be able to delay no longer, and I forced my mind back, carefully drawing him in my mind, tracing the long smooth arcs of his brows with my thoughts, as I had once traced them with my fingers. No matter that my fingers tingled suddenly with the memory of rougher, thicker brows and the deep blue of the eyes beneath them. Though this is just sort of the emotional context, which I didn't mention before, because you don't always need it, but there it is. I hastily turned toward the nearest face as an antidote to such disturbing thoughts. It happened to be Murtaugh's. Well, at least he looked like neither of the men who haunted my thoughts. Short, slightly built, but sinewy as a gibbon, with long arms that reinforced the simian resemblance. He had a low brow and narrow jaw that for some reason made me think of cave dwellers and pictures of early man shown in some of Frank's texts. Not a Neanderthal, though, a Pict. That was it. There's something very durable about the small clansmen that reminded me of the weathered patterned stones, ancient even now, that stood their implacable guard over crossroads and burial grounds. See, that's got way more adjectives than I would use now, but there you are. amused at the idea, I looked over the other diners with an eye to spotting ethnic types. This is your camera picking out individuals in the crowd. That man near the hearth, for example, John Cameron, his name was. He was a Norman, if I'd ever seen one. Not that I had. High cheekbones and a high, narrow brow, long upper lip, and the dark skin of a Gaul. The odd fair Saxon here and there, Leary, the perfect exemplar. Pale skin, blue-eyed, and just the tiniest bit plump. I repressed the uncharitable observation, but not for long. She carefully avoided looking at either me or Jamie, chattering animatedly with her friends at one of the lower tables. I looked in the opposite direction toward the next table, where Dougal Mackenzie sat, apart from Colum for once. A bloody Viking, that one. With his impressive height and those broad, flat cheekbones, I could easily imagine him in command of a dragon ship, deep-sunk eyes gleaming with avarice and lust, as he peered through the fog at some rocky coastal village. A large hand, wrist lightly haired with copper, reached past me to take a small loaf of oat bread from the tray. Another Norseman, Jamie. He reminded me of Mrs. Baird's legends of the race of giants who once walked Scotland and laid their long bones in the earth of the north. Okay, so we've completed our survey here and we picked out various faces. And you may notice that some of these come weighted with Claire's emotional relationship to the person she's looking at. Let's see, the conversation was general as it usually was, small groups buzzing between mouthfuls. But my ears suddenly caught a familiar name spoken at a nearby table, Sandringham. I thought the voice was Murtaugh's and turned around to see. He was seated next to Ned Gowan, munching industriously. Sandringham? Old Willie, the Arse Bandit, said Ned meditatively. What? Said one of the younger men-at-arms, choking on his ale. A revered duke has something of a taste for boys, or so I understand, Ned explained. Mm-hmm, agreed Rupert, his mouth full. So we see Rupert. Swallowing, he added. Had a wee bit of a taste for young Jamie here last time he visited these parts, if I remember rightly. That when, Dougal? 38, 39? 37, Dougal answered for the next table. He narrowed his eyes at his nephew. You're rather a pretty lad at 16, Jamie. Jamie nodded, chewing. Aye. Fast, too. When the laughter had died down, Dougal began to tease Jamie. It didn't kin, you are a favorite, Jamie lad. There's several about the Duke, as we've traded a sore arse for lands and offices. You'll notice I haven't got either one, responded Jamie with a grin, to further roars of laughter. What? Never even got close, said Rupert, chewing noisily. Good bit closer than I would have liked, truth be known. But how close would you have liked it, eh, lad? The shout came from further down the table, from a tall, brown-bearded man I didn't recognize. It was greeted with more laughter and ribald remarks. Jamie smiled tranquilly and reached for another loaf, undisturbed by the teasing. Is that why you left the castle so sudden and went back to your father, asked Rupert. Aye. Why, you should have told me you were having trouble that way, Jamie lad, said Dougal, with mock concern. Jamie made a low Scottish noise in his throat. And if I told you about it, you old rogue, you would have slipped a bit of poppy juice in my ale some evening and left me in his grace's bed as a wee gift. The table roared and Jamie dodged as Dougal hurled an onion at him. That's why you need to know what's on the table. Rupert squinted across at Jamie. Seems to me, lad, I saw you soon before you left going into the Duke's chambers near nightfall. You're sure you're not holding back on us? Jamie grabbed another onion and threw it at him. It missed and rolled away into the rushes. Nay, Jamie said, laughing. I'm a maiden still, that way at least. But if you must know all about it before you can sleep, Rupert, I'll tell you, and welcome. Okay, and this is the actual line of our action, is this story. So, amid shouts of tell, tell, he deliberately poured a mug of ale and sat back in the classic storyteller's posture. I could see Colum at the head table, head cocked forward to hear, as attentive as the ostlers and fighting men at our table. See the other specific glimpse. Well, Jamie began, it's true enough what Ned says. His grace had something of an eye for me, though being the innocent I was at 16. Here he was interrupted by a number of cynical remarks, and raised his voice to go on. Being, as I say, innocent of such carryings on, I'd no idea what he meant, though it seemed a bit strange to me, the way his grace was always wanting to pat me like a wee dog, and was so interested in what I might have in my scorn. Or under it, shouted a drunken voice. I thought it stranger still, he went on, when he found me washing myself at the river and wanted to wash my back for me. When he finished my back and went on with the rest, I began to get a wee bit nervous, and when he put his hand under my kilts, I began to get the general idea. I may have been an innocent, but no, a complete fool, you can. I got out of that particular situation by diving into the water, kilts and all, and swimming across to the other side, his grace being not of a mind to risk his costly clothes in the mud and water. Anyway, after that, I was better wary of being alone with him. He caught me once or twice in the garden or the courtyard, but there was room to get away with no more harm than him kissing my ear. The only other bad time was when he came on me alone in the stables. In my stables? Old Alec looked aghast. He half rose to his feet and called across the room to the head table. Colum, you'll see that man stays out of my sheds. I'll not have him frightening my horses, do you know? No troubling the boys, neither, he added as an obvious afterthought. Jimmy went on with his story, unperturbed by the interruption. Dougal's two teenage daughters were listening rapidly, mouths slightly agape. I was in a horse box, you can, and there was no room to maneuver much. I was bending over, more ribald remarks. Bending over the manger, I say, mucking up husks from the bottom. When I hear a sound behind me, and before I can straighten up, my kilts are tossed up around my waist, and there's something hard pressed against my eyes. He waved a hand to still the tumult before going on. Well, I did the cab match for the thought of being buggered in a horse box, but I didn't see much way out at that point either. I was just gritting my teeth and hoping it wouldn't hurt too much, when the horse, it was that big black gelding, Ned, the one you got at Muckleberry. You know, the one Colum sold the gentleman? Anyway, the horse took an objection to the noise his grace was making. Now, most horses like you to talk to them, and so did that one. But he had a peculiar aversion to very high voices. I couldn't take it in the yard when there were small bairns about, because he'd get nervous at their squeaks and start pawing and stamping. His grace, you might recall, has a rather high-pitched voice, and it was a bit higher than usual on this occasion, him being a trifle excited. Well, as I say, the horse didn't care for it, nor did I must say, and he starts stamping and snorting and swings his body round and squashes his grace flat against the side of the box. As soon as the Duke let go of me, I jumped into the manger and eased way around the other side of the horse, leaving his grace to get out as best he might. Jamie paused for breath and a sip of ale. He had the attention of the whole room by this time, faces turned toward him, gleaming in the light of the torchbearers. Here we're keeping track of our context, reminding us where we are. Here and there might have been discerned a frown at these revelations concerning a most puissant noble of the English crown, but the overriding reaction was an untrammeled delight in the scandal. I gathered that the Duke was not a particularly popular person at Castle Leoch. Having been so close, as you might say, his grace made up his mind as he'd have may come what might. So next day, he tells the Mackenzie that his body servant's fallen ill, and can he borrow me to help him wash and dress? Colum covered his face in mock dismay, to the amusement of the crowd. Jamie nodded to Rupert. That's why you saw me go to his grace's room in the evening, under orders, you might say. You could have told me, Jamie, I'd not have made you go, Colum called with a look of reproach. Jamie shrugged and grinned. I was prevented by my natural modesty, uncle. Besides, I knew you were trying to deal with the man. I thought it might impair your negotiations a bit if you were forced to tell his grace to keep his hands off your nephew's bone. Very thoughtful of you, Jamie, said Colum dryly. So you sacrificed yourself for my interest, did you? Jamie raised his mug in a mock toast. Your interests are always foremost in my mind, uncle, he said, and I thought that in spite of the teasing tone, there was a sharp undercurrent of truth to this, one that Colum perceived as well as I. He drained the mug and set it down. But no, he said, wiping his mouth. In this case, I didn't feel that family duty required quite that much of me. I went to the Duke's rooms because you told me to, but that was all. And you came out again with your arsehole unstretched? Rupert sounded skeptical. Jamie grinned. I did. You see, directly I heard about it, I went to Mrs. Fitz. I told her I was in desperate need of a dose of syrup of figs. When she gave it to me, I saw where she put the bottle, and I came back quiet a bit later and drank the whole lot. The room rocked with laughter, including Mrs. Fitz, who turned so red in the face, I thought she might have a seizure. She rose ceremoniously from her place, waddled round the table, and cuffed Jamie good-naturedly on the ear. Said, that's what became him a good physic, young wretch. Hands on her hip, she wagged her head, making the green ear baubles wink like dragonflies. The best lot I ever made, too. Oh, it was most effective, he assured her, laughing up at the massive dame. I should think so. When I think what that much physic must have done to your innards, lad, I hope it was worth it to you. You can't have been much good to yourself for days after. He shook his head, still laughing. I wasn't. But then I wasn't much good for what his grace had in mind either. He didn't seem to mind at all when I begged leave to remove myself from his presence. But I knew I couldn't do it twice, so as soon as the cramps eased up, I got a horse from the stables and lit out. It took a long time to get home, since I had to stop every 10 minutes or so, but I made it by supper next day. Dougal beckoned for a new jug of ale, which he passed down the board, hand to hand to Jamie. Your father sent word he thought perhaps you'd learned enough of castle life for the present, he said, smiling ruefully. I thought there was a tone to his letter I didn't quite understand at the time. Well, I hope you've laid up a new batch of fig syrup, Mrs. Fitz, Rupert interrupted, poking her familiarly in the ribs. His grace is like to be here in a day or two, or are you counting on your new wife to guard you this time, Jamie? He leered at me. From all accounts, you may need to guard her. I hear the Duke's servants does not share his grace's preferences, though he's every bit as active. Jamie pushed back the bench and rose from the table, handing me out. He put an arm around my shoulders and smiled back at Rupert. Well then, I suppose the two of us will just have to fight it out, back to back. Rupert's eyes flew open in horrified dismay. Back to back, he exclaimed. I knew we'd forgot to tell you something before your wedding, lad. No wonder you've not got her with child yet. So, anyway, as I say, that's my very first attempt at writing a mob scene, so to speak. And, you know, it works fairly well because it's a short, condensed story that Jamie is telling, and most of it is his telling it. But you see how it works, that we'll periodically break his story for Claire to notice someone else's reaction to it, and or an actual reaction, like Mrs. Fitz getting up and swatting him over the ear. And, you know, little bits of physical action, like throwing onions at each other and so forth. You need to have a certain amount of physical action to break up any kind of conversation, whether it's, you know, minor body things or noticing the expression on someone's face or interruption from outside, or, you know, you close your eyes because the intensity of the moment is too much and you're, you know, thinking of something else. You know. Lie back and think of England, that kind of thing. So that is the first example. Let me read you, with commentary, a recent example. This one is from the book that I am presently writing, or I would be writing it if I weren't here talking to you. It will be done by the end of the year, by the way. Yeah, I don't know when it will be out exactly, because that's up to the publisher, but you know, soon thereafter. People always say, well, when is your book coming out? And I said, well, with luck, after I write it. Oh, anyway, this is many years later on Fraser's Ridge in North Carolina. Jamie and Claire have a family and so forth. And this too takes place in a kitchen. They don't all, and if we have time, I'll read you one that takes place not in a dining context and so forth. But here the Frasers are still in the process of building their new house, the old one having been burnt down in a previous novel. We'd eaten supper on our new front stoop, there being no table or benches for the kitchen as yet. But for the sake of ceremony, I had made molasses cookie dough early in the day and set it aside. Everyone trooped inside and unrolled their miscellaneous bedding. All these people are not leaving because they're bored. They have appointments with agents and things, and blue pencils. Everyone trooped inside and unrolled their miscellaneous bedding. Jamie and I did have a bed, but everyone else would be sleeping on pallets before the fire, and sat down to watch with keen anticipation as I dropped the cookies onto my girdle. This is actually how Scots pronounce griddle. It's a girdle. I had one book reviewer say, this book is so badly copy edited, people are cooking things on a girdle. That's Scots for griddle, and you would know that if you had actually read the book. So, to watch with anticipation as I dropped the cookies onto my girdle and slid the cool black iron circle into the glowing warmth of the brick oven. How long, Granny? Mandy was behind me, standing on tiptoes to see. I turned and lifted her up so she could see the girdle and cookies in the glowing shadows of the brick cubbyhole built into the wall of the huge hearth. The fire we had lighted at dawn had been fed all day, and the bricks around was a radiating heat and wood all night. See how the dough is in balls? And you can feel how hot it is. Don't ever put your hand in the oven. But the heat will make those balls flatten out and turn brown, and when they do, the cookies will be done. It takes about 10 minutes, I added, setting her down. It's a new oven, though, so I'll have to keep checking. And here's the visual, you know, we're seeing our context where we are and getting a quick glimpse of it. Goody, 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 goody. She hopped up and down with delight, then threw herself into Brianna's arms. Mama, read me a story till the cookies are done. Bree's eyebrows lifted. She glanced at Roger, who smiled and shrugged. Why not, he said, and went to rootle through the pile of miscellaneous belongings stacked against the kitchen wall. You brought a book for the bairns? That's bra, Jimmy said to Bree. Where did you get it? Do they actually make books now for children Mandy's age? I asked, looking down at her. Bree had said she could read a bit already, but I'd never seen anything in an 18th century print shop that looked like it would be comprehensible, let alone appealing, to a three-year-old. Mm-hmm. Well, more or less, Roger said, pulling Bree's big canvas bag out of the pile. That is, there are, a few books that are intended for children, though the only titles that come to mind at the moment are Hymns for the Amusement of Children, The History of Little Goody Two-Shoes, and Descriptions of 300 Animals. What sorts of animals, Jamie asked, looking interested. No idea, Roger confessed. I've not seen any of those books, just read the titles on the list. Did you ever print any books for children in Edinburgh? I asked Jamie. He shook his head. Well, what did you read when you were in school? As a bear, the Bible, he said, as though this should be self-evident, and the almanac. After we learned the ABC, we could read a bit of Latin. I want my book, Mandy said firmly. Give me Daddy, please, she added, seeing her mother's mouth open. Bree shut her mouth and smiled, and Roger peered into the sack, then withdrew a bright orange book that made me blink. What? Said Jamie, leaning forward to peer at it. He looked at me, eyebrows raised. I shrugged, he'd find out soon enough. Read it, Mummy, Mandy curled into her mother's side, thrusting the book into Bree's hands. Okay, Bree said, and opened it. Do you like green eggs and ham? Do you like them, Sam I am? What, said Fanny incredulously, and moved to peer over Bree's shoulder, closely accompanied by Germaine. What is that? Germaine asked, fascinated. Sam I am, Mandy said crossly, and jabbed a finger at the page. He got a sign. And what's the other thing then? Who are you? That made Fanny, Jimmy, and Roger laugh, which turned Mandy incandescent with rage. She might not have the red hair, I thought, but she had the Fraser temper in spades. Shut up, shut up, shut up, she shrieked, and scrambling to her feet, made for Germaine with the obvious intent of disemboweling him with her bare hands. Whoa, Roger snared her deftly and lifted her off her feet. Calm down, sweetheart, he didn't mean. I could have told him, but if he hadn't learned it from sharing a household with assorted Frasers for years, it wouldn't do any good to tell him now. That the very last thing you should say to one in full roar was calm down. Like putting out an oil fire on your stove by throwing a glass of water on it. He did, Mandy bellowed, struggling madly in her father's grip. I hate him, he ruined it, it's all ruined. Lego, I hate you too. She started kicking dangerously in the vicinity of her father's crotch, and he instinctively held her out away from him. Jamie reached out, wrapped an arm round her middle, gathered her in, and put a big hand on the nape of her neck. As I say, sometimes you have actual physical action that you're following, you know, visually. Hush, Ian, he said, and she did. She was panting like a little steam engine, red-faced in teary specifics, but she stopped. We'll step outside for a moment, shall we? He said to her and nodded to the rest of the assembled company. No one's to touch your book while we're gone, do you hear? There was a faint murmur of assent, succeeded by total silence, as Jamie and Mandy disappeared into the night. The cookies, smelling the strong scent of incipient scorching, I darted to the oven, snatched the girdle out, and hastily flipped the cookies off onto the big plate. See, this is the physical context. You know, we put the cookies in, and at some point we should remember, along with Claire, that they are there and in danger of burning. Snatched the girdle out and hastily flipped the cookies off onto the big plate, the only pottery dish we owned at the moment, but capable of holding anything up to a small turkey. Are the cookies okay? Jam, with a total disregard for his sister's immediate prospects, hurried over to look. Yes, I assured him, a bit brown at the edges, but perfectly fine. Fanny had come too, but was less intent on gluttony. Oh, Mr. Fraser Whipper, she whispered, looking anxious. No, Germaine assured her, she's too little. Oh, no, she's not, Jimmy assured him with a wary glance at his mother, whose face was distinctly flushed, if not quite as red as Mandy's. You see how the different kids come in with just enough so that you can see them, and their very distinct voices. All the children had clustered round me, whether out of interest in cookies or from self-preservation. I lifted an eyebrow at Roger, who went and sat down beside Brianna. I turned my back to allow a little marital privacy, and sent Fanny and Jim out to fetch the big pitcher of milk, presently hanging in the well. And I did hope none of the local frogs had decided to avail themselves in defiance of the stone-weighted cloth I draped over the pitcher's mouth. I'm sorry, Granny, Germaine edged close to me, low-voiced. I didn't mean to cause a stramash, truly. I know, sweetheart, everybody knows except Mandy, and Grandad will explain it to her. Oh, he relaxed at once. Having total faith in his grandfather's ability to charm anything from an unbroken horse to a rabid hedgehog. Go get the mugs, I told him. Everyone will be back soon. The tin mugs had been rinsed after dinner and left upside to dry on the stoop. Germaine hurried out, carefully not looking at Bree. Germaine thought she was angry with him, but it was apparent to me that she was upset, not angry. And no wonder, I thought sympathetically, she'd tried so hard for so long to keep Jim and Mandy safe and happy. Luckily, Roger's instincts as a husband were quite good. He had his arm around her and her head resting on his shoulder and was murmuring things for her, too low for me to catch the words, but the tone of it was love and reassurance, and the lines of her face were smoothing out. I heard soft voices in the other direction, too, through the open kitchen door. Jamie and Mandy evidently pointing out stars they liked to each other.
I smiled, arranging the cookies on the platter. He probably could charm a rabid hedgehog, I thought. With his own good instincts, Jimmy waited till the mob had reassembled and was eagerly sniffing the warm cookies. Then he carried Mandy back in and deposited her among the other children without comment. 27, he said, assessing the array at a glance. Yes, how do you do that? Ah, it's no difficult, Sassenach. He leaned over the platter and closed his eyes, inhaling beautifully. It's easier than goats and sheep, after all, cookies than have legs. Legs? Said Fanny, puzzled. Oh, aye, he said, opening his eyes and smiling at her. To know the number of goats you have, you just count the legs and divide by four. The adult members of the audience groaned, and Germaine and Jem, who had learned division, giggled. That, Fanny began, and then stopped, frowning. Sit, I said briskly. Jem, pour the milk, please. And how many cookies does each person get, then, Mr. Know-It-All? Three, the boys chorused. A dissenting opinion from Mandy, who thought everyone should have five, was quelled without incident, and the whole room relaxed into a quiet orgy of cold, creamy milk and sweet-scented crumbs. Now then, Jamie said, and paused, carefully brushing crumbs off his shirt front into his palm and licking them off. Now then, he repeated, Amanda tells me she could read her book by herself. Will you maybe read it to us, Aliena? Yes. With only a brief interruption for the wiping of sticky hands and face, she was ensconced once more in her mother's arms, but this time the vivid orange book was in her own lap. She opened the cover and glared at her audience. Everybody shut up, she said firmly. I read. So you can see how that one works. You know, we're following, you know, both the progress of the cookies, the progress of the argument, and the settling of everyone back into harmony with the passing out of the cookies and so forth. So it's kind of a congruent one. You see how we have the vivid orange book ending that, so to speak. And we see it at the beginning and then again at the end, being the instigating thing for the conversation, even though it's not the real point, so to speak. So I should pause for a refreshing snort here and see if anyone has questions. Yeah?
Yeah, I just was wondering, does it help to go, are those voices that distinct right from the get-go, or do you have to go back to the—
No, they're usually pretty distinct to me. Occasionally I will have just a, what you might call a bit character, who's only there momentarily, you know, like one of the people in the dining room scene, whom I didn't name. It was just somebody I don't know who had popped up with a question. Those you don't pay much attention to, because they're just used for interruption, so to speak, and interjection, or perhaps to put in a little bit of factual information that you need, but you're not going to use that character anymore. They're just kind of a placeholder. That's like when you zero in the camera on someone with a non-speaking role, just because they're wearing a red hat in the scene, and therefore the eye will pick them up and people want to look closer. A lot of it lies in thinking about what you personally would want to see if you were in the middle of this scene, and then making sure your reader can see it too. That's how film editors work. They say, well, we want to see more of this, you know, so let's look for more footage, you know, that extends this particular person. Yeah, there's somebody back there. Yeah.
What is that? I think you described it as a rump.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Maybe with more R's because they're Spanish. Yeah, now people are always asking me, what about Jamie's Scottish noises and so forth? And they range, you know, Clara's adept at deciphering them. But they're very useful because I can say he made a deep Scottish noise conveying, and then it conveys whatever emotion. So that saves me having to try to make him say something that conveys that emotion. So forth, it's a nice shorthand. But, yeah. Anybody else on this side? Don't want to be. There you go.
That's okay. It seemed to me in that last scene that the cookies was a device that mm-hmm. you used to sort of set up the scene and then have a conclusion.
That's right.
Was that part of it when you first conceived of the scene, or was it something you added to sort of bring the argument to a conclusion?
It was sort of fortuitous. I didn't actually think consciously of it that way. So like I said, I don't actually plan things out ahead of time. All I intended with this was to provide a setting in which we would begin to see what Brianna has in her bag, which has been, you know, a source of great curiosity. She's got a lot of stuff in her bag, and we saw one or two things so far in the story that she's pulled out when the occasion demanded it. And so now this is the first book that she's brought out. So I wanted us to be able to see that. So obviously as a kid's book, we needed to have the kids there. And you know, I was thinking, where would we have kids and so forth? Well, given their physical situation, they're either outside around a campfire or they're inside in their rudimentary kitchen. And I said, well, obviously inside at the kitchen. So what would you be doing if you're in a kitchen and, you know, kitchen plus kids equals cookies? You know, that's it. That scene didn't necessarily start with the cookies. It started somewhere with Brianna pulling the book out of her bag. Then I had to decide which book it was. And I was thinking, well, I have new grandsons and so forth who have massive amounts of books. But, you know, the Dr. Seuss books, you can always tell because of the very vivid coloring. And especially Green Eggs and Ham is bright, bright orange. Yeah, there's someone in here, I think. No? Okay. Great. Well, you?
Did you have to get permission from the Seuss estate to use that lamp?
Well, I asked, you know, I sent the scene to my editor and I said, you know, I would really like to use this quote. It might be fair use, but since it's a children's book, which is short, you know, you can't use song lyrics, even very short, because the song is so short that, you know, even one verse is too big a percentage. And I said, I don't know, but, you know, can you have the legal department check? And she did, and they came back and they said, no, we think that's all right. So at least I have an opinion on record that they thought it was all right, which means that they can't then, if the Seuss estate should sue me and win, they would have to pay for it. So we will hope it doesn't come to that. Yeah, now I could, of course, use the name of the book, and do, which is Green Eggs with Ham, and of course everybody gets it at that point. And so she's actually only quoting one line, "Do you like them, Sam I Am?" Yeah, and that's the only actual quote, which is luckily apparently small enough that I can do that. But yeah, there's other things in other places, and some of them are under with copyright or very vague. For instance, in this book, there's a longer scene that I've written, which ends with Jamie reciting a poem to Claire, which is a translation of an Irish poem, which I picked up out of a book called Celtic Folklore. And this is obviously an old traditional poem, which is totally out of copyright, but the translation is probably not out of copyright. And so we don't know about that. You know, where does the ground lie under that? And so I told my editor about this, and it is included in a whole book of Celtic folklore. Now, the person whose name is on the cover obviously did not write the originals of any of these stories, but I don't think he translated them either. He's a fairly modern person. I think that he, you know, collected them and then probably edited them for, you know, similarity of tone and to give them a flow, but basically they are just, you know, stories and poems scattered throughout the book. But his name is the only one on them. He's not citing particular translators or sources for any of the stuff in here. He's just telling it as though he were himself a bard, which is a perfectly legitimate thing to do. But from a legal point of view, I mean, if he screwed up and did not include stuff that he should have, that's bad. But, you know, also if somebody suddenly from my book says, I recognize that poem, you know, I translated it, you know, where is my attribution? And then they start coming back to my publisher, well, then we have to tell them where I got it and so forth. So again, they wrote back to me and said, can you tell us exactly which page of this book it's on so we can locate it specifically, and then our legal department can look into it. Yeah, it's a short poem, but you know, but I'm quoting it in its entirety, so it would be good if I can use it. But traditional stuff, usually there's no problem.
I've read all the big books, but I have a question about mob scenes, as it were. How many lines would you have, if it's a very intense, say, plotting for something during the American Revolution, how many characters would you have speak in succession before you felt the need to throw in something to set, to give those other details that you were talking about? I mean, would you go very long, going back and forth saying he said she, you know, he's general.
Rule of thumb is don't do more than four lines of dialogue without a physical interruption. Yeah, could just, and by physical, I mean not only what you're talking about, but the way it looks on the page. You know, he said, she said, he said, she said. And then, you know, you need a solid paragraph that says something else. It could be something that one of those people is thinking about rather than something that they're noticing, but all it needs is, you know, just the visual change. Because, you know, you read lines that look too much alike and people lose their focus. Yeah, so it's what print looks like on the page is almost as important as what the print actually says.
Right, it adds something else as well, because then you know what the people are thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can put in what they're thinking, what someone says, you know, maybe someone glances aside at a time when everyone else is looking at the speaker and whoever's noticing them is thinking, he sees something I didn't see, you know, what was it? And that sort of thing. So you can introduce suspense and you can explicate things. It's you can pretty much slip in anything you want as long as you keep it brief. But because people are following the actual thread of the story, whether it's conversation or action, as in the cookie thing. Yeah, for sure. Anybody else? OK. Okay. Well, as I said, there is a particular. The other one. This is the one drawback to. I mentioned elided point of view. Like I said, this is kind of advanced stuff and not something that you would normally do. One of the drawbacks of writing in the first person is that you can only say what your person, your first person narrator, sees, what they're experiencing directly, which makes it hard to introduce stuff that they weren't present for. And sometimes you can do it just by telling a story, as in Jamie explaining what happened with him and the Duke of Sandringham and making it, you know, kind of a public conversation and so forth. But, you know, for something that contains some more general activity or for which there's an air of suspense or something, that's more difficult to do. So this is a way of using a third person point of view embedded inside the first person point of view. So you give the audience the illusion that they are remaining inside the head of your point of view character who is listening to this story, but then you're telling the story as though you were inside the third person, which means that you can use summary narrative. I assume you know what that is. That's where you're not, you know, spelling things out, but you're saying, you know, this happened, essentially, without, you know, listing all the steps that happened, and, you know, or this is the history of what happened, and so forth. We'll see a couple of examples of it as we go along here. Okay, this is from The Fiery Cross, and without a lot of background. The supposition was almost instantly borne out by a high-pitched shriek from the back of the house. I poked my head out into the hall just in time to see Mrs. Bug race out of the kitchen as though discharged from a cannon, screaming in panic. Not noticing me, she shot past and out of the front door, which she left hanging open, thus enabling me to see her cross the dooryard and vanish into the woods, still in full cry. It came as something of an anticlimax when I glanced the other way and saw an Indian standing in the kitchen doorway, looking surprised. We eyed each other warily, but as I appeared indisposed to screaming and running, he relaxed slightly. As he appeared unarmed and lacking paint or any other evidence of malevolent intent, I relaxed slightly. Osio, I said cautiously, having observed that he was a Cherokee and dressed for visiting. He wore three calico shirts, one atop the other, homespun breeches, and the odd drooping cap, rather like a half-wound turban that men favored for formal occasions, plus long silver earrings and a handsome brooch in the shape of the rising sun. He smiled brilliantly in response to my greeting and said something I didn't understand at all. I shrugged helplessly but smiled in return, and we stood there nodding at one another and smiling back and forth for several moments, until the gentleman, struck by inspiration, reached into the neck of his innermost shirt, a dressy number printed with small yellow diamonds on a blue background, and withdrew a leather thong on which were strung the curved black claws of one or more bears. He held these up, rattled them gently, and raised his eyebrows, glancing to and fro as though searching for someone under the table or on the cabinet. "Oh," I said, comprehending immediately, "you want my husband." I mimed someone aiming a rifle. "The bear killer?" A flash of good teeth and a beaming smile rewarded my intelligence. "I expect he'll be along any minute," I said, waving first at the window, indicating the path taken by the exiting Mrs. Bug, who had undoubtedly gone to inform himself that there were red savages in the house bent on murder, mayhem, and the desecration of her clean floor, and then in the direction of the kitchen. "Come back, won't you, and have a drink of something?" He followed me willingly, and we were seated at the table, companionably sipping tea and exchanging further nods and smiles, when Jamie came in, accompanied not only by Mrs. Bug, who stood close to his coattails, casting suspicious looks at our guest, but by Peter Bewley. Our guest was promptly introduced as Tsatsatwi, the brother of Peter's Indian wife. He lived in a small town some 30 miles past the treaty line, but had come to visit his sister and was staying with the Bewleys for a time. "We were having a wee pipe after our supper last night," Peter explained, "and Tsatsawi was telling my wife about a difficulty in their village, and she telling it to me, you see, him having no English and me not speaking so very much of their tongue, know but the names of things and the odd politeness here and there. But as I say, he was telling about a wicked bear what's been a plaguing of them for months past. Okay, we're all perfectly standard up to this point, you know, we're explaining why it's somebody else's story, but we're so far just talking to Peter. So, I should think Tsatsawi well-equipped to deal with such a creature by the looks of it," Jamie said, nodding at the Indian's necklace of claws and touching his own chest in indication. He smiled at Tsatsawi, who evidently gathered the meaning of the compliment and smiled broadly back. Both men bowed slightly to each other over the cups of tea in token of mutual respect. "Aye," Peter agreed, licking droplets of liquid from the corners of his mouth, smacking his lips in approval. See the specificity. He's a bounty hunterist, that's how we, and in the usual course of things, I expect he and his cousins might manage well enough. But it seems as how this particular bear is perhaps that wee bit above the odds. So I says to him as perhaps we'll come and tell McDo about it, and maybe as himself would spare the time to go and sort the creature for them. Peter lifted his chin to his brother-in-law and nodded toward Jamie with a proprietorial air of pride. See, said the gesture, I told you, he could do it. I suppressed a smile at this. Jamie caught my eye, coughed modestly, and set down his cup. I kind of come just yet a while, but perhaps when the hay is in. Do you ken what's the nature of this problematical bear, Peter? Oh, aye, Peter said cheerfully. It's a ghost. I choked momentarily on my own tea. Jamie didn't seem too shocked, but rubbed his chin dubiously. Well, what's it done then? The bear had first made its presence known nearly a year before, though no one had seen it for some time. There had been the usual incidents of depredation, the carrying away of racks of drying fish, or strings of corn hung outside houses, the stealing of meat from lean-tos, but at first the townspeople had regarded this merely as the work of a bear slightly more clever than the usual bear being completely unconcerned as to whether it was observed in the act. And see, this is where we slide into the elided point of view. This is something that Peter is telling Claire, derived from what he has heard from his brother-in-law. But it's given as a summary. Bear had first made his presence known and so forth. But we slide it in as part of the original conversation. So we are remaining in Claire's head, and this is what she's hearing. And then we return to the actual flow of conversation. It would only come at night, you see, Peter explained, and it didn't make a great deal of noise. Folk would just come out in the morning and find their stores broken into and not a sound made to rouse them. Brianna, who had seen Mrs. Bugs' unceremonious exit, had come up to investigate the cause, began humming softly under her breath, a song to which memory promptly supplied the words. Oh, he'll sleep till noon, but before it's dark, he'll have every picnic basket that's in Jellystone Park. I pressed a napkin to my mouth, ostensibly to blot the remains of the tea. The kitten was a bear from the first eye, Peter explained, footprints. That's how we knew that word. He spread his two hands out on the table, thumb to thumb, demonstrating the span of the footprint, then touched the longest of the claws hung round his neck, nodding significantly. The townspeople, thoroughly accustomed to bears, had taken the usual precautions, moving supplies into more protected areas and putting out their dogs in the evening. The result of this was that a number of dogs had disappeared, again without a sound. Evidently, the dogs had grown warier, or the bear hungrier. The first victim was a man, killed in the forest. Then 6 months ago, a child had been taken. Brianna stopped humming abruptly. So you see, we're doing the summary narrative again, but then we introduced Brianna, so we realized that we're still listening and we're still in Claire's viewpoint. The victim was a baby, snatched cradleboard and all from the bank of a river where its mother was washing clothes toward sunset. There had been no sound and no clue left, save a large clawed footprint in the mud. Four more of the townspeople had been killed in the months since. Two children picking wild strawberries by themselves in late afternoon. One body had been found, the neck broken, but otherwise untouched. The other had disappeared. Mark showed where it had been dragged into the woods. A woman had been killed in her own cornfield, again toward sunset, and partially eaten where she fell. The last victim, a man, had in fact been hunting the bear. They didn't find anything of him, save his bow and a few bits of bloodied clothes, Peter said. I heard a small thump behind me as Mrs. Bug sat down abruptly on the settle. So we come back into Peter's narrative at the end of this, though in fact he's not been speaking in dialogue up to this point. Those preceding six paragraphs are all his summary. So they should have hunted it themselves, I asked, or tried to, I should say. Or so they have hunted it themselves, I asked, or tried to, I should say. Peter took his eyes off Jamie and looked at me, nodding seriously. Oh, why, Mrs. Claire, that's how they kent what it was, finally. A small party of hunters had gone out loaded, literally for bear, armed with bows, spears, and the two muskets the village boasted. It circled the village in a widening gyre, convinced that since the bear's attentions focused on the town, it would not wander far away. They had searched for 4 days, now and then finding old spoor, but no trace of the bear itself. That's how he was with them, Peter said, lifting a finger toward his brother-in-law. He and one of his friends were sitting up at night, keeping watch whilst the others slept. It was just past moonrise, he said, when he got up to make water. He turned back to the fire, just in time to see his friend being dragged off, stone dead, his neck crushed in the jaws of the thing itself. That's how he had been following the tail intently. At this juncture, he nodded and made a gesture that appeared to be the Cherokee equivalent to the sign of the cross, some quick and formal gesture to repel evil. He began to talk himself then, hands flying as he pantomimed the subsequent events. He had, of course, shouted, rousing his remaining comrades, and had rushed at the bear, hoping to frighten it into dropping his friend, though he could see that the man was already dead. It makes sense for Sathawi to take over the narrative at this point because he's telling it personal experience, not just recounting the history. And so that's why we introduce him then, but he doesn't speak English, so we drop back into the summary narrative, which Peter Bewley is, of course, interpreting for Claire and Jamie, and this is what Claire is gathering from this, but we don't need to go through that process because we're using an elided point of view. He had, of course, shouted, rousing his remaining comrades, and had rushed at the bear, hoping to frighten it into dropping his friend, though he could see that the man was already dead. He tilted his head sharply to indicate a broken neck, letting his tongue loll in an expression that would have been quite funny under different circumstances. The hunters were accompanied by two dogs, which had also flown at the bear, barking. The bear had, in fact, dropped its prey, but instead of fleeing, it charged toward him. He had thrown himself to one side, and the bear had paused long enough to swipe one of the dogs off its feet, and then disappeared into the darkness of the wood, pursued by the other dog, a hail of arrows, and a couple of musket balls, none of which had touched it. They had chased the bear into the wood with torches, but been unable to discover it. The second dog had returned, looking ashamed of itself. Brianna made a small fizzing noise at Setsawi's pantomime of the dog. See, this is how you get back in a dialogue tag of some of sorts, while reinforcing the impression that it is a pantomime. And the hunters, thoroughly unnerved, had gone back to their fire and spent the rest of the night awake before returning to their village in the morning. From whence, Setsawi indicated with a graceful gesture, he had now come to solicit the assistance of the bear killer. But why do they think it's a ghost? Brianna leaned forward, interest displacing her initial horror at the tale. Peter glanced at her, one eyebrow raised. Oh, I, he didn't say, or rather I expect he did, but not so as you'd understand it. The thing was much bigger than the usual bear, he says, and pure white. He says when it turned to look at him, the beast's eyes glowed red as flame. They can't at once, it must be a ghost, and so they weren't really surprised that their arrows didn't touch it. Setsawi broke in again, pointing first at Jamie, then tapping his bear claw necklace, and then, to my surprise, pointing at me. Me, I said, what am I got to do with it? The Cherokee heard my tone of surprise, for he leaned across the table, took my hand in his own, and stroked it. Not in any affectionate manner, but merely as an indication of my skin. Jamie made a small sound of amusement. You're very white, Sassenach. Perhaps the bear will think you're a kindred spirit. He grinned at me, but Setsawi evidently gathered the sense of this, for he nodded seriously. He dropped my hand and made a brief cawing noise, a raven's call. Oh, I said, distinctly uneasy. I didn't know the words in Cherokee, but evidently the people of Setsawi's town had heard of white raven as well as the bear killer. Any white animal was regarded as being significant and often sinister. I didn't know whether the implication here was that I might exert some power over the ghost bear or merely serve as bait, but evidently I was indeed included in the invitation. And so it was that a week later, the hay safely in and four sides of venison peacefully hanging in the smokehouse, we set off toward the treaty line bent on exorcism. Oh, let's see, that's a lot smoother than my first attempt. You can kind of see how it works, I think, that you stay in Claire's viewpoint. It's all stuff that she would be hearing, would be thinking, and yet you're dropping into the viewpoint of someone who's not actually speaking. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a good way to get across a story that you don't want to have interrupted by a lot of other stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, in the back there. Yeah, his rendition of what the other guys told him, yeah.
It's
the story itself, but without being in dialogue form, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it.
It's tricky.
It is, yeah. No, As I say, I think I've only used it three times. The other time was, I think, it may have been in Fiery Cross as well, but maybe in Breath of Snow and Ashes, but it's where they're in Cross Creek, and a lot of people are besieging the printer shop and wanting to tar and feather the printer, and Jamie is, basically saving him by trying to, talk the crowd out of it, and meanwhile all kinds of other stuff is going on, and there's interruptions from Jezebel, Hatfield, and so forth, looking for her husband, whom she finds and chases in the middle of it. It has a lot more physical interruption, and I didn't read it just because it's a much longer scene, and then Fergus finally saves the day by ripping a feather mattress that's hanging out of the windows and shooting feathers all over the whole square, causes everybody to flee, and they can extract the printer safely. Yeah, so that one's in there if you want to look at that. That's a very complex one, but I think that's the only other one I've done. Usually you don't need to do any lighted point of view, but it's useful if you have a long story that has, quite a bit of background in it, and it would be awkward just to tell it as a dialogue back and forth, because dialogue, normally you don't want it to go on for more than a couple of lines. Having big chunks of dialogue is another thing that causes people's eyes to cross and they quit paying attention. Whereas if you tell it to them in summary, they'll go right along. Yeah? Anything else? Well, that's really all I can tell you about how to do this. It's, I mean, in concept, it's very simple. It's just difficult to execute. And, you know, to manage a mob is not really that hard. It's just keep an eye on where your scene is going. You know where you are, know whose point of view you are in, and don't let your point of view waver. You can, in any lighted point of view, it looks like you're shifting it, but you're really not. But you really are at the same time. But normally in a mob scene, just when you have a lot of people talking, you would still stay right in your narrator's point of view. And so you would be getting his or her reaction to what's going on, as well as, you know, the actual account of events. And you would just have interruptions from smaller participants in the discussion. But she would mostly be focused on whoever is telling, you know, the story or conducting the argument or something like that. I mentioned the scene in from season two with Jamie and Prince Charlie and the chiefs, and I wrote that episode, so I was on set while it was being filmed, and so I could see it, you know, and what was going on. Anyway, that morning they blocked the scene, which means that they're going to kind of walk through the motions and see if there's anything in their way. You know, they have to move or change or whatever, and so they did. And Sam comes out with this side in his hand. A side is just one or two printed pages that are that actor's lines for the scene that they're shooting or for that day's shooting, and so they don't try to memorize the whole script. In fact, there are no certain actors, not Sam for one, but several other actors who don't even memorize their sides. Sort of look at them briefly before the take starts. Sometimes they make it through and sometimes they don't. But there is a script manager standing by who has the entire script. And you know, if the actor suddenly freezes, the script manager will usually give them like 20 seconds, you know, in case this is part of what they decided to act. But if it becomes clear that in fact they just can't remember, she'll, you know, murmur the next line to them. And sometimes they'll just stop dead and go line, and, you know, I give up, they can't do it. Yeah. And more frequently they stop and go, oh shit. Line, please. But yeah, anyway, so this particular one, he comes out and he says, well, we've been blocking this scene. Jamie has to do this particular speech, you know, kind of explaining why they have to go on to London. They must do this, you know, in order to save the rebellion. And then he reaches Bonnie Prince Charlie's side and, you know, makes a, you know, moving declaration of his loyalty and so forth. And he said, but I've been doing this and I can't say the whole speech in the time it takes me to walk from one end of the table to the other, even stopping to glare at people along the way. So I said, can I delete the first two lines? And I said, no, I think we want those because this. I said, but we can take out the last line, and what if I rewrite the middle line so it's like this, it's much shorter. I'd try that, and so we did, and that worked. But that's, you don't usually have to do stuff like that when you're the writer on set, but you know, you catch things on the fly. And there's usually at least one writer of the block on set, so somebody else is doing it for me at the moment, because they are filming my episode for season 5 this week, along with, well, they would be if it weren't Sunday. Along with episode 512. So Matt and Tony wrote the finale, so one or both of them are on set, and they would be catching anything that needs to be changed in my script as you know, production requires. Yeah, someone else was had a question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm still sort of thinking about your saying no more than 4 lines of dialogue.
That's rule of thumb. I mean, you can't violate that. You know, it's just a general pattern.
And that would be one person speaking?
No, that would be a back and forth, you know. Oh my God, he said, you know. Oh my God, I said. And, you know, you can't do that, he said. I can, I said. You know, that kind of thing. Don't do that more than, you know, two exchanges.
Okay. So I'm also thinking, I mean, all those pieces you read, they're just so smooth. Like, even the interruptions, it still keeps the...
Yeah, keep your eye on the thread of what's of the action or of, you know, the conversation. Sometimes it's the same thing as in that last one that I read. But yeah, you know, the reader wants to know what happens next. So tell them what happens next. You can interrupt that very briefly with, you know, these little specific glimpses of, you know, that's always pantomime of the dead man and things like that. But not by much. Keep your eye on it. And that's basically how you manage it, is just follow what your reader wants to know. Yeah, you had a question.
I'm just wondering, as a, you know, first-time novelist, rules of thumb, like, you know, 4 lines of dialogue without interruption, those kinds of rules of thumb are actually really, really useful to know, to watch out for, because I think sometimes if I'm writing any book, you know, I don't realize that I should be looking out for that until much later, and I go back and reread it as if I was reading a normal book, you know, not mine, and then I realize, oh, that's dreadful. Are there any other rules of thumb like that that you could share with us?
Well, I'm sure there are lots of them now. Yeah, the thing is, you know, writers really don't have any secrets. Anything we can do is right there on the page. The only problem is to learn how to read it, how to read like a writer rather than like a reader. I learned to read at the age of 3, so I've read, you know, literally thousands of books. And when you do that, you begin to distinguish the patterns that are characteristic of good fiction versus bad fiction. And sometimes you'll see, well, this is really unusual. You know, most books that I read would not do this, but it's working. Why is that working? And you can usually tell, you know, it's working because of the particular quirky personality of the person speaking, which allows you to go on for longer in that voice without distracting people, or, you know, other things like that. But yeah, there are lots of patterns. I mean, everybody knows don't use too many adjectives, but there are exceptions to that. Sometimes you need a lot of adjectives. And basically, the underlying rule here is that any given sentence should be a good sentence, not just in what it says, but in the balance and the euphony of it. You can read them aloud, and sometimes you can tell whether it's a clunky sentence or an okay sentence, or a really ravishingly beautiful sentence. I mean, this is how I always start writing. As I said, I don't plan them. But what I need for any given day to start, or I'm writing when I'm writing a new scene. I may have some vague idea of what the scene is about or where it goes. Sometimes I don't, but I will have what I call a kernel, which is a very vivid image, a line of dialogue, an emotional ambiance, you know, smell, anything that sticks in my mind that I can sense very concretely. And so I will just look at that, whatever it is in front of my mind's eye, and I will write a sentence describing it. And it can be any kind of a sentence. At that point, I'm just trying to describe what I'm looking at or sensing, in other words. And then I sit there and I stare at it, and I take words out, and I put words back, and I move the clauses around, and I write a second sentence. I don't like that. I move it away, so I can't look at it right now. And I go on and say, maybe another one, or maybe not. Maybe I should stop there, start a new paragraph. Anyway, I'm making all these tiny little craft decisions in the front of my mind, trying to make that sentence as, you know, beautiful, elegant, and euphonious as I can, while maintaining, you know, its description of what I'm looking at. And at the same time, that frees up the back of my mind, which is asking all these subliminal questions, like, what time of day is it? Where is the light coming? You know, did someone just say something? Is there a fire in the room? Are my fingers cold? That kind of stuff. So let's see. Yeah, we have about 10 minutes here. So let me answer this question, and then I will give you my 90-second party trick in which you can watch me write. Yes, what was your question?
Oh, it was just when you have a mob scene or more than 2 people, and your point of view character is not present.
Ah,
what? This is a more general craft.
That is
question,
a more general one, yeah.
But it's kind of
what you do
by this mob scene. What do you do?
Yeah, I've never had that happen because I always have a point of view character either present or, you know, vicariously present and so forth. But yeah, you can do that, especially if you're writing from an omniscient point of view, which I totally can't do, but other people do. Anyway, what you would do is take the second rule, which is follow the line of the action through that. Yeah. What exactly is happening here? Make sure you answer the questions as in what happens next, you know, which is what people want to know at that point. Okay, anything else I should answer right now? Okay, you can ask more questions when I do this. But okay, I describe the ways in which I write, and a lot of people are going, you can't possibly be doing it that way, especially the people who think in a straight line, but about half of us do, in fact, do it that way, you know, in a kind of a network fashion. If you're a linear writer, you write like people lighting up a string of Christmas lights, you know, red, green, yellow, blue, red, orange, and, you know, you get your whole string lit, it's all pretty, you wrap it around your Christmas tree, and voila. Okay, the rest of us write like those networks of lights that you throw over your cactus or your front wall because you don't want to do strings that way. And it just lights up, bing, 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 bing. And when you're done, you know, the whole thing is lit up, you throw it over your cactus and, you know, voila. Nobody can tell whether you did it one way or the other way once it's done is the point here. But part of being a writer is to learn how your own brain works and work with it instead of against it. You know, almost any book about how to write that you read will tell you, well, you must have an outline. And I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said, well, I'm having such trouble with this book, you know, I can't finish the outline, and so I can't, you know, move into the writing, and I know everything about, you know, chapters 1, 2, and 3, but I just don't have any idea what happens in chapter 4.
And I say, do you have an idea what happens in chapter 6? And they say, oh yes. And I said, well, write that, you know. And I say, but. It's like, no, it doesn't matter. You know, nobody can tell if you wrote the book backwards. You know, it only matters what's on the page. Nobody can see how your brain works. It's totally all right to make it happen any way that you can, any way that feels comfortable to you. So, you know, people's brains are wired up in an amazing variety of confirmations. What works for you will not work for someone else, and vice versa. Now, frankly, I don't read how to write books, and I never have, partly because I did start reading so early and was just, you know, I was up to here, soaked in fiction and so forth. And so I was thinking, it's, you know, I can see what's happening in these books. Why would I be reading someone's analysis of it? And, you know, I've read little bits that I go to conferences and so forth, so you'll read, you know, things that people have handouts and things like that. And I'm looking through it, I'm like, man, what a way to write. But, you know, if it works for you, that does. Yeah, then, as I say, many people listen to me describe how I write, and they're going, that can't possibly work. So I started doing this at two conferences where I'd say, you want to watch me write? Okay, give me 90 seconds here. So on this particular cold day, I call it a cold day when I have no idea what to write. You know, I finished a scene yesterday. I knew how to write yesterday. Today, I have no idea. But same as to everybody all the time, totally normal. Yeah. So I said, okay, what am I going to write? I got no idea. Well, I'm sitting in my office. I have 2,500 books about the 18th century and various aspects of it, of medicine, revolution, everything. So usually what I do in these circumstances is just take out a book that looks appealing and start flipping through it in search of something that strikes my fancy. And so on this particular day, I picked up an old Sotheby's catalog I have that is Scottish silver and glass of the 18th century. So I said, okay, everything in here is going to be apropos at least. So that's how I look here. So I'm flipping through, and here is this nice elegant goblet made of crystal with thistles incised into its sides. And it's a Jacobite goblet. And anyway, and it's got white roses around the bottom. And well, you can't tell that they're white because it's glass, but you know, you recognize a Jacobite rose after a while. So I'm looking at this goblet and thinking, oh, that's interesting. Okay, let's do that. So I go back to my computer and I'm typing the crystal goblet. And I'm saying, do I need to say it's crystal? Do I need to say it's a goblet? Well, let's see, if I could say the crystal glass, but no, I can see that stem rising, that goblet shape, that's important. Okay, I do want to say it's a goblet. Is it important that it's crystal? You know, could it be silver? Could it be something else? No, there's light passing through it. I can see that it's glass. If it's this kind of fancy goblet, it's got to be crystal. The crystal goblet, okay. All right, well, I see light passing through it. Where is the light coming from? Oh, it's coming from the right here. Well, you can't say the light passed from the right through the crystal goblet. No one cares where the light's coming from, except me. Okay, so the light... I'm looking at it. The light is, well, it's coming in low through the window. It must be the middle of the afternoon. And I'm thinking the late afternoon light passed through the crystal goblet. Well, so what? You know, the light, there's something about that light. The warm honey, well, it's not warm and honeyed, it's blue. That light has that bluish tinge that you get in the winter when light's reflecting off snow. Okay, well, now I know something I didn't know before. It's winter. Okay. All right, the blue light. Well, you can't just say the blue light came in. There might be a, you know, ambulance outside. The blue light of late afternoon. Well, no, you need to get winter in here somewhere. Yeah, the blue light of winter afternoon. That's kind of clunky. Maybe I need one more adjective. The cold blue light of winter afternoon. Well, it's late winter afternoon. Let's try late winter afternoon. I like that because the late alliterates with the light. All right, the cold blue light of late winter afternoon. Cold blue light of a late winter afternoon passed through the glass. Did it pass through the glass? Did it fall through the glass? No, it passed through. I can see it. It's on the other side. Well, of course, it's glass, dummy. Yeah, okay. The late blue light of cold afternoon. No. The cold blue light of a late winter afternoon passed through the crystal goblet and did what? Did it strike the wall on the other side of the room? Well, no, it didn't because it's refracting. It went splat on the table. Well, it didn't go splat because light doesn't make any noise. Fell, passed through the crystal goblet and fell on the tabletop. That doesn't seem quite right. I mean, it sounds like it went splat, made a noise or something. Maybe I can describe the light that it's casting. Oh, that's the word, casting. Okay. The light passed through the crystal goblet, casting a pool on the tabletop. Sounds like the crystal goblet took a whiz on the tabletop. Yeah, okay, back up. The cold blue light of a late winter afternoon passed through the crystal goblet. Do I need to stop and put in the thistles? No. The late blue light, cold blue light of a late winter afternoon passed through the crystal goblet and cast a pool of amber light. I can see it. It's definitely glowing. Cast a pool of amber light on the polished wood of the tabletop. I can see him. Hey, the cold blue light of a late winter afternoon passed through the crystal goblet, casting a pool of light on the polished wood of the tabletop. And now I know where I am. I'm in Jocasta Cameron's parlor because she's the only person who would have a glass window rather than one bird with a hide, and a polished wood table, and a crystal glass full of whiskey. That's why the light is amber, it's full of whiskey. Said not everybody does it that way. There's probably easier ways, but this is just how it works for me, which is one of the reasons it takes me a long time to write a book, because this is what happens with pretty much every sentence, but that is why it flows, because, you know, that's what I can do if you're constantly fiddling with things. And like I said, I said this thing and that sounds clunky. Okay, if it sounds clunky, you can fix that. Yeah, so I fix everything as I go through, and of course there will still be things. The only person who reads what I'm writing while I'm writing it is my husband. I will print things off when I finish a scene and leave them by his sink at night when I go to bed. And he'll take them out and read them with his early coffee and bring them back at lunchtime with, you know, marginal comments like nipples again. Or you're doing it again, sort of thing. But, you know, usually good comments. And I'll say, yes, that's right. Or, you know, if I have something about horses, he may add a marginal comment saying, yes, but, you know, talk to me about this. And I'll add something else that I'll use somewhere. But he's got a really good literary eye. And if I give him something and have a note on it saying there's something wrong with this, but I don't know what it is, he'll find it and he'll tell me exactly. He'll say, it's this person right here. This thing that they said is not characteristic of how they would be feeling at that particular point. Or, you know, this particular person just would not say that at all. And I'll look at it and say, oh, you're right. Yeah, well, maybe somebody else should say it. Or maybe, you know, it needs to be a conversation between these two people, so he's got to say something different. Or maybe he doesn't say that until later when it will make more sense. Or, you know, that he gives me a starting point from which to fiddle with things. Yeah, other than that, you know, eventually it goes to, well, it actually goes to three editors in the US, the UK, and Germany. The German editors will sometimes come back with just a technical question, you know, like, does this really happen, or so forth. But normally it's my German translator who goes through it, because she's doing exactly what I'm doing, but in German. But, you know, finding a way to make the sentences flow, which means, you know, necessarily changing some kinds of things. So sometimes she'll write to me and say, well, this particular concept actually doesn't exist in German. Can I say this instead? And I'll look down and I'll say, yeah, that's okay. Yeah, but you know, they will give me feedback. Sometimes they'll say, I didn't quite understand why this happened here. And I'll say, oh, well, that's because I accidentally excised the part that explains it, and I'll go stick it back in, yeah, or something like that. Or they'll say, I really love this part, but I want to know more about this particular thing. And I say, that can be done. Yeah, so there's usually not a lot of this, for one thing. We're usually working pretty fast when we get to this stage. But it is good to have outside eyes, people who catch things. One thing that I often do is to inadvertently repeat things. I will have written two scenes, you know, 2 years apart that basically cover the same territory. Well, I find them both when I'm assembling things and, you know, absentmindedly include them both in the same section but in different chapters. And so, you know, people who are reading will necessarily notice that, and they'll tell me and say, hey, you've got the same, different versions of the same thing happening here and here, which one do you want? Which is very helpful. I mean, it saves me a lot of time if they read that and find it, instead of my having to go back. I do read the entire manuscript over several times, which is time consuming because they're really big. So I tend to read it in smaller chunks as we go along and read them and read them and read them. Because you will always pick up something you can improve. So, you know, it's just obsession. Obsessive attention to detail, let's say. Yes, one more question back there.
You just spoke about assembly, and I was going to ask about that. How do you go from a bowl full of beautiful beads or scenes that you book with the way your person works for you?
Well, I think in shapes is basically what it is. And I write all these things. And each scene has its own particular shape. Well, at a certain point, I'll have kind of critical mass for a section, say, or a couple of chapters. And I can see that this particular thing goes with this particular thing because this explains why that happened. So I'll bring these two together in what I call an assembly buffer, which is an open file, and put them there. And then I go and look for other pieces that might be following the same thread, which, you know, it's in my head, so I know these pieces exist. I just have to locate them. And I keep what I call a master file or M file for each book. And all that is a list of file names with a few keywords next to each one so that I can find the files when I want them. And so I say, okay, I need this particular file in which William is having a conversation with Dennis Randall.
And so I just open the M-file and type Dennis, and it will show me all six scenes in which that happens. And I can tell from a quick look which one it is that I want here. So I pull those in, and I have these, and I say, well, these all go together, but they don't go here, so let's open a separate buffer and put them over here. And so I have chunks that develop. And all the time I'm writing, and I do the research along with the writing, and so I'm developing this kind of historical timeline in the back of my head where, you know, different important events happen. And when I have chunks, I can begin to line those up along that timeline because I need to know where they happened. I won't have known that when I wrote this particular chunk, but I'll be writing and thinking, okay, this has to happen before the Battle of Monmouth because I happen to know that this person is killed in the Battle of Monmouth, and here he is, so obviously this chunk goes over here. And, you know, I line those up. At a certain point, I will have critical mass on the whole book, which means I will have seen the shape of the book, and I will know what's missing, and I can then fill in those missing pieces. That's where I am now. I have critical mass, and then we are in a state where I can sit down, and I have a dozen things that I could write at that particular moment. You don't have cold days at this time, at this point. Yeah.
So you work in Word, then?
I work in Word.
You work in Word or Scrivener?
Oh, Word, yeah. Yeah, it's just by default.
You
it's not a good program. I hate it.
Work in Word.
Well, I mean, it's just a way of getting words on the page and moving them around.
People tell me I'm wrong for not using Scrivener. I'm like, you know what? Diana Galvin works in Word.
Yeah, well, you know, I have tried Scrivener a couple of times, you know, their free things. And, you know, given enough time, which might be I'll have after I finish writing this book, maybe not, I might sit down, you know, and actually learn it and go through their exhaustive tutorials. And I'm just thinking, it takes you 2 hours to learn how to use a stupid word processor, you know, is this actually worth the effort? Yeah, but I've used it enough to see what it does. And what it does is what my brain is doing by itself anyway, so, you know, I do that. It's cheaper. But the other thing is that Word lets me color the backgrounds of documents and Scrivener does not. That's the main thing. I need to color code my stuff because I'm usually working with up to a dozen documents open at any one time, and I need to be able to see which one I am going to.
How do you color code by scene or?
Not usually by scene, but by section and and chunk. And then things like my M file is always a bright scarlet red. I can find that, huh? Yeah.
Very technical. How many screens do you use?
How many screens do I use? Well, you know, it's how many tabs you have open, essentially, or how many documents you have open.
Yes.
You use multiple monitors.
Just one.
Yeah. With multiple.
Oh, yeah, just one. Yeah, I have a big Alienware is my laptop. It's a 17-inch screen, yeah, and it's a big gamer machine and with screaming memory and so forth, and so I can keep up to 40 or 50 tabs open along the top, which I do because I'm keeping the film dailies for 2 weeks or so running across the top, plus my research tabs, plus my social media stuff. It's all along the top there. And then in Word, I usually have, as I say, up to a dozen different documents open at the bottom of the screen. So I need the room, and I need to be able to access and save things like that. So do I have it in my head all the time? Yeah. Yeah. That's a very benign form of ADHD, I think. Yeah. Now, is there anyone on this side that I'm missing? Yeah. Okay. Anyone here? Yeah. All right. Let's go and have lunch.
Thank you.